Right eye dominant.
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 This is the Right Eye Dominant Podcast.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Right Eye Dominant Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Toro Jr. And for today's episode, I'm really excited to share a conversation that I recently had with photographer Todd Heido. If you're at all interested in contemporary photography, you most likely know the name Todd Heido. And at the very least, you are probably familiar with his body of work. Most notably, a series of photographs he called House Hunting that are beautiful color photographs taken at night. But there is a lot more to Todd's artwork and his life as a photographer, and we talked about a lot of it on this episode. So just a couple of notes before we jump into the conversation. Todd and I had a very, very, very long conversation. We jumped on and off Zoom several times while recording this. And to that end, I have edited it down. It will still run longer than most of my episodes. And what I'm going to do is I'll drop in a couple of breaks to make it a little bit easier for those of you who don't have the opportunity to listen all in one straight listen. But with that, I'd also like to add that Todd and I mention many photographers who he's either studied with or have influenced his work in some way. And I'll make sure to include links in the show notes to all of those references, because I think it's a really good way to kind of see the work of others and then how it impacted his work as well. So I'm going to jump into this episode now. I want to say thank you to Todd for taking the time out to talk with me. And it really validated the reasons why I'm doing this podcast in the first place, is really just to share my enthusiasm for photography with other people. And Todd absolutely shares that mindset as well. So without further ado, let's jump into the new episode. Here's my conversation with Todd Heido. Welcome to the Right Eye Dominant Podcast, Todd Heido.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. You know, one thing that's ironic about the name of your podcast and asking me to do it is that I am absolutely left eye dominant, because I can't even close my left eye to look through a camera with my right eye.
Interesting.
I can only do it this way. So yeah, so I'm left eye dominant, but I think, I don't know which way my brain works, but anyhow.
And what's funny is you asked me if this was going to just be an audio or video recording, and we're both blinking our eyes.
Right, exactly.
As
you're talking about that. Yeah, for the listeners, I'm closing my right eye. Yeah,
so okay. I'm closing my left. Okay. So Todd, what was your path to photography? What got you into it in the first place?
My mom used to work at a drugstore in Ohio. I grew up in Kent, Ohio, and we had this little we had these Instamatic cameras, and I'm pretty sure she was taking the film and getting it processed for free. But like, I was 10 or 12, and there's all these pictures that I have that I made at that period of time, like just of like any kid would make, I have a pet turtle that I photographed, and like I would photograph my brother jumping ramps, because I used to race BMX. And that was my real, like, after I ended up like deciding, like it's almost like any kid today with like an iPhone and a skateboard, we had the impetus way back then to record the things that we did. And I picked up a 35 millimeter camera as a teenager, and I started taking pictures then, and that like dovetailed into it being like the thing that really honestly like photography sort of like changed my life in a way that was just, it gave me direction, because I raced bikes for a while, and I was actually the state champ in Ohio for 4 years for BMX. And but I also like after sort of like I got a car, started driving, I started partying and doing stuff. And then, but ultimately came back to photography, and photography was that thing that like lifted me out of where I was and brought me to where I am now. And I've never stopped like doing it since I was, 16 years old.
Mm. I did see or read that you studied in Pittsburgh. Is that correct?
My education was basically that I grew up in Kent, Ohio, and then I went to a small school in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, for a couple of years, and it was more like a kind of like a trade school for photography.
Mm.
And it was there that I learned from one or two very important teachers that there was more in the world. There was more than what they were teaching there, and there was a world of art photography. And then one of my teachers, he had asked me if I wanted to go to this workshop in California for the Friends of Photography, and this was like in 1988, I think.
Mm.
And it was this. I mean, it was this workshop with Jim Goldberg, Bill Burke, Judy Dater, and Joyce Tennyson.
Wow.
And it was like, it was the extended portrait. And I went, and that thing blew my mind. And I just was exposed to like this zone of photography that I was, that was new to me, because in like where I came from in Ohio, it was Kent State University was there. And my father wasn't a professor there. He was a plumber, in Kent, but there was this store called International News and Tobacco. And I remember going to that store because they had magazines, and they had magazines from everywhere. And I remember looking through those. I didn't buy them because I couldn't afford them, but I would look at them. And I remember like seeing like Andy Warhol's interview, and I would look at them, and I would see all these things out there. And I was like, there's something beyond this place I'm in, and I need to like get out of here. Mm-hmm. And that's what I did. And I started it in Pittsburgh, and then I ended up going I was there for several years. And then I ended up going to Boston, to the Boston Museum School, technically called the School of the Museum of Fine Arts.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of the most when I got to that school, the museum school, that's when everything started to fire at all like full cylinders for me, because I the teachers that I worked with, every one of them had either had Harry Callahan or Aaron Siskin as their teacher.
Wow.
And it was just, and they were and the direct descendants of the Bauhaus, like Laszlo Moholy-Nagy brought Harry Callahan into that fold. And we were basically like, that was like, those were my, that's the roots of my photography.
Well, there's a couple of things I want to ask you about, and they're kind of in different places. But one of the things that, and I think just judging by your year description, I think we're probably around the same age. When those names came up, the workshop in California, I immediately, I picture that I know those people, I know their work. And I imagine myself at that age of being like, just had I been exposed to that kind of experience, what that must have been like. But then also when you went to study in Boston, there is this photo lineage. And I think that there's something about, and it's a generational thing, obviously, but like, when we were cutting our teeth and getting educated and having sort of like direct connection with people who were studying with these masters of the art form, and having that sort of opportunity to sort of glean, all of that education and inspiration in that way, and then having it passed down to us. And in some ways, I think that's a drive for me for even doing this podcast, is sort of like, well, younger kids who, need to learn the craft or learn the history. I think it's just really valuable. But to hear that, you were like one or two degrees of separation away from these icons.
Holy Nagy. Yeah, yeah. Like literally, I mean, which I find to be like, I'm really interested. I love the history of photography is one of my most interesting, like, and favorite topics of like, it's kind of curious how that works. It's like, you know, but like there's a lineage in like photography, and then, you know, for me coming out of that, but let's call that the Bauhaus lineage. And then I was in Boston, and then I graduated, and I was already getting a little restless with things, but like, and then also one thing that's curious about that moment in time for me is everybody, like to me, an 8x10 print was a large print, mm-hmm. Because we were making these really fine prints. I remember like, and Harry Callahan, like literally would come, he came to our school and talked to us. And like, and we also got to like one of our teachers, Virginia Bean, her neighbor was Emmett Gowan.
Mm-hmm.
And
I know Emmett's work.
And Emmett is like one of the most incredible photographers that's ever walked this earth. And I've learned so much from his work and from him in particular. And like this teacher I had, Virginia Bean, she had this thing where like she wanted to take us out into the world and show us things. So like one of the things that we got to do was like go to Emmett Gowan's house, you know, and I got to go into his dark room. And then mm-hmm. you would see that it's like this guy that's this artist that's making this incredible work that is like on view at the moment, at that time, the Philadelphia Museum of Art, the place where Rocky, you know, Balboa did yeah. that, like, you know, yeah. like that museum, he had a retrospective there. And then we're in his house as like a group of 15 students. And then like, he just lets us walk around and look at stuff. And then you realize it's like, it's a totally ordinary house, and his dark room where he was making some of the greatest prints ever. What was a small little side room upstairs that would have, like, in a lot of cases in the Midwest, been a sewing room. Mm. But it was his dark room, and he just had his negatives like just stacked up. They weren't like filed in these like crazy like archival sleeves. They were just stacked up, and I just remember like, wow, like this is where this happens. And the genius of my teacher Virginia Bean was that. And I don't know if she even knew this at the time, but she let us see that the people that were making the most amazing work were just regular people. And there wasn't anything particular. They didn't have anything special. Like, they had special things in their head and their eyes and in their heart, but there wasn't anything other than that. They didn't have the special cameras. They didn't have the specialist. They didn't have the greatest dark rooms. It's like, and that was like such an incredible thing to see. And then the other part about that was really educational was seeing that, like, how did people make a life in photography? You can imagine like, you know, like we build, like we see something on a wall at a museum, or we get a book at a bookstore, and we have, you know, as viewers, we have these imaginations that are probably like just grandiose about what's occurred, how this get here, who they are, how they do it, like, gee, I can't do that, you know. But you realize that, like, they're just people, just like you and I, and that, you know. And one of the things I always tell to my students is like, you know, the same stuff that gets in your way of making your work and doing what you want to do is also in my way every day, and I just try to push through it all, and I try to carve out space in my world to make my artwork, because that's the place that, like, that makes me, like, you know, that's, you know, for me, like, I mean, having done this since 1988, you know, it's my career, but it's also like, but you still, like, you know, I still gotta carve it out. I gotta push the time, like, mm-hmm. you know, and all that. So I gotta make time to make my work. And like, just like, you know, other people like probably have that same feeling.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, yeah, what a valuable thing to see at an age and at a time when it really clearly has informed how you proceeded with, you know, your life in photography.
Another experience that I had with them was Frederick Summer is the photographer who was Emmett Gowan's, Emmett Gowan might say that, you know, the two people that informed his work, like, the greatest were Callahan and Summer.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I actually got to meet those two people and sit down and talk to them. in those contexts, and what a joy, you know.
Yeah.
It's amazing, you know. And then the thing about what's really cool about what we do now and what we're doing this very moment is that because of technology, you and I are sitting down and we're talking and in a real way. And it's not imagining what I do. You're finding out what I do for real firsthand.
Yeah.
We're sharing that. And that's super great, I think.
It is. And I don't want to go down a rabbit hole on this, but you mentioned something earlier when you would go to the magazine and tobacco store and see the magazine shop and see the row of magazines from that. To me, I could smell that space. And for those of us who were, it's pre-internet, right? But that was where, but that in some ways was like your little sort of wedge to the outside world.
It was literally the window to the outside world out of Ohio, you know, which was like oppressive and could not wait till I left as soon as I could. And I've never lived there since. I needed to go away from that place and become what I've do what I've done and all that.
That leads me to, you ended up then studying in California.
Yes.
With Larry Sultan. I would love to hear just a little bit about that experience in the same sort of way that you described your connections with education in the East. Sort of the precursor though is that, like you described the lineage from Callahan back to Bauhaus, the sort of, there's this East Coast sort of academia or art world. You're on the opposite coast now. And to me, Larry Sultan is a California photographer.
Very much.
So tell me a little bit about that sort of what that felt like, the difference from coming from the Midwest to the East to California.
Yeah, it was expansive, in all ways. I remember I mentioned earlier in our conversation that I was in Boston studying, and I was at the end of my schooling. I was a little bit restless, and so I was already thinking about because there was there was a certain way things were done there, and it was really important and very informative, but I knew there was something else out there that I was looking for. And then I remember one of the things that we would do when we were in Boston is we would drive to New York to go to Soho, and then later on, I don't even know if Chelsea existed at that point.
Probably not.
To Soho, but we would go to Soho and we would just see as many shows as we could, go to the Museum of Modern Art. And then there was a show at the Museum of Modern Art that I saw that was crucial to my being in California. And it was called The Pleasures and Terrors of Domestic Comfort. And it was a show, I think it was in 1991 or 92. And it was basically about people who photograph their families. And but it wasn't all this happy, rosy story. It was about the pleasures and the terrors of that. And that was one of the first times that I had seen an exhibition about people who photographed their family that had a critique on it in a way. And one of the key figures in that show was Larry Sultan. And I remember seeing his work I think a lot of times some of the best work or the work that means the most to somebody, when you first see it, sometimes you don't quite get it all. You don't understand it instantly and it confounds you a little bit and you need to figure it out. And then, and his work, I knew there was something, there was five pictures I saw and there was something about it that really intrigued me. And then I had, because I had earlier mentioned also that I had been to California, San Francisco for the Friends of Photography workshop in 88. I remember thinking, oh, I really liked San Francisco. And that, and then I learned that Larry Sultan taught in, at CCA, it was called the California College of Arts and Crafts, at that point. And so I ended up applying to school here and I remember going to visit him and I met him in an interview and we just clicked instantly. And it was one of those things that, like, one of the most important relationships I've ever had in my entire life is with Larry Sultan. And it was a mutual, like, we got something from each other the whole time. For me, like, that was the major shift in that was my work changed drastically, I think, in some way, because I like I'd mentioned before, to me, in Boston, a big print was 8x10, because all my little pictures from my portfolio were like 5x6 or 4x5 inches. Mm-hmm. And then when I came out to school here, like, everybody did color around me, and they were all like, you know, and then I was like, and they were making 20x24 prints and larger. And then I knew that, and of course I also, like, I got into school on the East Coast and other places, but I knew that I wanted to make a change. And so, and I always told myself, I didn't, like, you know, move 3,000 miles away to just do what you were doing. You moved here to experiment and to explore different things. And so I started doing color. And that was the first, like, in graduate school, like, with Sultan, was the first time I did color. And it was, you know, and then the first time I made large prints. And then Larry was one of the people that sort of, like, gently pointed out to me that the pictures I was taking, that I was taking at that time, even though they were of homes and interiors, they were about family, and they were about people, and they weren't about architecture, and they weren't like that. Like, he showed me that you could make a picture of a house and have it be about your family life. It essentially became house hunting. I had like 5 pictures when I left graduate school, and I just kept, you know, going on making those images. And like, but he was the one that, like, steered my vision into what that work was about.
Mm-hmm. What I know about him and his, you know, his body of work, not only my first introduction was the Evidence series,
yes,
which from a conceptual standpoint blew my mind, because, right, I was just like, what the, you know, it took photography and created this different context around the images. But I learned that just by virtue of selection or the structure of a sequence, yeah, that you could take images that were created for something completely different. It was like an intellectual practice,
yep,
applied to a very sort of, you know, the images that he was working, they were working with.
Mike Mandel.
Right.
Yep.
Were taken for very specific utilitarian reasons. And then you look at the photographs, but they're presented in, obviously, in a book form or in an exhibit, in a different way. And I just remember trying to, like, figure out, like, what the fuck does that, like, what is, like, why was, right, this picture taken in the first place?
Right.
But now I'm interacting with it as, like, I'm in a museum and I'm seeing it. And what does that mean?
Right.
That to me, just, like, aside from his other, like, his family work, his parents, which is staggeringly beautiful and emotionally just incredible. And I do see, I see what being exposed to his work, where that led you in your work, for sure.
Right. And then curiously, like talking about Evidence, that is, I mean, that kind of thinking that he instilled in me, is probably more influential than his pictures of his family, because it was the way that Larry thought about things, and that he would take, I mean, like you said, he would pull a picture out of the California Department of Transportation, like, you know, files. And then he would take one from like a police lab, a police crime lab, and he would put these together, or we would like, somebody testing like a like, you know, like shaving cream and foaming it up as big as they could in this bizarre picture. But like, they had the strangest pictures, and Larry was the one that taught me about context And Larry was the one that taught me about sequence. And Larry was the one, most importantly, I think, for my work, he instilled this idea of narrative. And that when you take one picture and you put it next to another picture, you cannot not think of something. You know, as a human, we have like our brains are, we have to connect dots. And that is one of the most important things that I think I learned from him is that like, that there's an activation that occurs between two photographs. And then you're the, and then as an artist, it, you know, like it's not your job to create the meaning, but it's your job to like charge the air so that that meaning can occur and that it's not always the same thing for every person. Mm. And that's the beauty of it is everybody reads it in their own way. Cause you bring yourself that like the meaning of the image resides in the viewer. And that's something that I've always like held close. And I remember like that's somewhere in my thesis from graduate school, like that exact comment and that because it's because I believe it's true.
Mm. I love the description of that. You charge the air. That's so it's like you're setting an environment, but really it's like there's energy that you're creating, but then you're allowing the viewer to enter it and interact with the imagery and on their terms and whatever right. they're, you know, whatever they're bringing to it is, it's actually a beautiful metaphor. I really like that.
Thank you. And I really believe that is like, cause you can't control, like you can only like you put your artwork out there and it's going to be interpreted, whether it's music, whether it's acting, whether, and no matter what it is, people are going to interpret it on their own in their own way. And it's going to be different each and every, it's every interaction is unique.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I thought that would be a good place to take a little pause in the conversation and give you all a breather. If you are listening to this in chunks, maybe this is a good time to pause it. If not, I'm just going to keep on rolling and get right back into the conversation. Here is part two of my chat with Todd Heido. And you actually just mentioned something before I started recording, so traveling. Do you shoot where you live?
That's a really good question, actually, because I always remember Sally Mann is one of my like one of the people I love her work very much, and I always remember like being like envious of like, oh, your family's right there and you can just make pictures all the time and do and like you it's like it must be so productive. And of course that was a window of time in her world, but I always kind of like I knew and I learned from that as a photographer, we inherently want to roam. And I am absolutely a wanderer of like one of my most favorite things to do is just to drive in a car and look mm-hmm. and go somewhere I haven't been before. But I also at the same time knew enough that you can't rely on that exclusively for your image making because you won't get enough stuff done. So I've learned how to shoot here in California, close to my house. Like all the house hunting photographs, not all of them. The majority of like the initial ones are made 20 minutes from here in Pacifica. Mm. And it was this neighborhood that I had found that like, I'll never forget the first time I went there, I was new to California and I just started driving around and went up, you know, I went to this neighborhood I'd never been to. And I went up this hill near the ocean. And then in California in the summer, that equals fog. Basically, like, it's like, if you're close to the ocean, there's a marine layer. And if you're at a certain level, it's just literally you're in the clouds. And there was this neighborhood that I discovered, which is where you've seen like a lot of my house hunting photographs. And then the thing that struck me about that was, I was like, holy shit, this is like everywhere else in America, but it's like stocked in fog. And it's this dreary, dark place that's like ripe with metaphor and mystery. And I just knew that I made a picture there one night, and I went back the next night and I made another picture, and then I kept going. And I've probably been to that neighborhood like hundreds and hundreds of times, literally, over the last, like since 1995 probably was when I found that. And so making work close to home is an important thing, but then at the same time, traveling is really important, because we all know when we're, and then one of the first things we, you and I started talking about was like all the nonsense that gets in the way of you being creative, right? And that is called daily life. Mm-hmm. And so, and I've raised, like, you know, I have twins that are 20 years old, and they've launched out in the world. I always had like all the stuff that gets in the way of working, of daily life, you know. So basically, but when you travel, you're free of that, you know, or you at least can like put it at bay for, you know, a good chunk of the time. Like, so one of the things I used to do is I would, and I still do, you know, like I'd fly somewhere, you know, and then just rent a car, and I would drive around for 3 days and take pictures, you know. Mm-hmm. And I would like very, I would like, you know, I've honestly been almost everywhere in the United States, doing that. And some places are like ripe for me and some places aren't, but like one of the places that I found, and this is the irony of it, is that reminds me more than anything of home, and which is like the area near Spokane, Washington, which is in eastern Washington, which is that there's these rolling hills and it's farmland. Because I like Kent, Ohio, like we all know Kent State University, mm-hmm. but you don't know what's around Kent State University. Kent State University was like, Kent is a small little city, but it's all around there was farmland, like when I grew up. And then like when I would ride my BMX bike to some other town, I'd be riding down these country roads. And that was like, and when I went to Spokane to start taking pictures and just started driving around south of Spokane, it's really about the rural part, is that I was instantly like transported to this place that was like, just like the little roads I would ride my bike down as a kid, you know. And there's something about like, sometimes you have to travel to find like the places that are familiar, mm-hmm. which sounds weird, but it's true, you know. And especially in this changing world we have, it's like the air, like that area of Washington is like, you know, of course, along the freeway, there's all the Home Depots and all the restaurants and all that stuff. But when you dip down into like the farmland, it is like exactly like my Ohio of 1985.
Let me challenge you then on something, because it's interesting the way you describe that. And earlier in our conversation, you said, I wanted to get out of Ohio and never go back.
Right.
And your work is like trying to connect with home.
Connect with home. It is. And it's not the weird psychological trick that we play on ourselves. It's like, you know, and then even back, I'll bring this back to Larry Sultan, because in graduate school, we used to have these like independent study units that we could use with other people. It was basically intended so like for us to like, you know, like get some feedback from a photographer that didn't work at the school, or a curator or something like that. And then I remember there was a woman that I used to, that lived in my building when I was in graduate school, and she was raving about this art therapist that she would used to see. And I was like, I'd never been to therapy in my life, and I couldn't afford it. And like, but I always remember like, there's something about that thing that she's so energized when she gets back from that. Like, I'm curious. And then I remember talking to Larry, and this is where Larry, he'd be like, well, why don't you use an independent study unit with the art therapist? And I was like, bingo. And I did it. And I was able, my school was able to pay this man to basically help me analyze my own artwork and learn from that. And then, and it was expansive, you know, because, and then I was also, and then I'll remind you, I was 23 or 24 years old, and I had this therapist that was looking at my art that I was making. And then we only worked with my artwork. We didn't like cut up National Geographic and make a collage. Like, we just looked at my pictures and talked about them. And then he showed me and gave me the confidence that I was absolutely doing exactly what I was supposed to be doing, and that the content of my work and what I was photographing was what I was supposed to be photographing. And that was really, and imagine like being like 24 and like, and I remember like once we kind of like ended that, those sessions, like I was like, I mean, I didn't have any doubt about what I was doing. I just did it. And that's what happened to me, you know? And that's, I think, was largely like one of the key reasons that like I was able to get my work out and like just not look back and just charge forward for the last 20 years. And because it's like, I had the confidence that it was like, I didn't doubt myself.
Yeah. That's amazing to, again, at that age, just to, it seems that you put yourself into situations throughout your life, at least when in your education or that sort of you are needing something, and the thing that you need somehow made its way in front of you and you seized upon, which is, I think that's the other thing. It's like you're describing that. I'd love to have a session with that therapist.
Right. And it could be any therapist that, that looks at your images and talks about what the where they come from with you.
But when, like, the age you were and the thrust that it gave you, the not only confidence, the validation in your vision.
And that's important. That word validation is really important because you know how hard it is to make art, you know, and there was, I felt like there was a gift that had been given to me at that moment in my life, you know, and I think that I've always been, I'm a decisive person. Like I don't ruminate for much. I mean, I'm not like impulsive, but I'm also like decisive. And I just, if there's something I want, I decide to do it and I do it. And that was like, and I remember thinking like those, connecting those dots. I'm like, that's, I'm doing this, you know, and it was very helpful, you know.
Wow. That's amazing. So I want to talk a little bit then about the work specifically. It seems that, you know, we started talking about the, what you're calling the house hunting. And I don't know if I've been to Pacifica, but I've been to San Francisco. I know the fog as you're describing it and what that creates as far as light is concerned. But then, I mean, I've spent plenty of time on the Atlantic coast, and the sort of the mist at night creates this sort of atmosphere that I think contributes to the sort of the power of your night photographs. Why at night? I've seen, you know, I've seen other of your photographs, and it's not exclusively night photography, and I know but like those photographs, color photography at night, I think there's those two things together that I couldn't imagine them any another way. But what brought you to that approach?
I think what brought me to that approach was that I've always been a night owl, and I've always, like, even as a teenager, like, my mom would have a hard time getting me to go to bed, like, you know, like early enough. And I just always like been activated at night. And so I think that, and it's also the time of day when back to those, like, what gets in the way of you making your artwork, all the things you have to do, you know? And so at night, those things are, you know, your family goes to sleep. You know, your friends aren't around, you're alone. And those are the conditions that lead to making artwork for me. It's my quiet time in my head. I've done all the things I have to do, and then I'm free to think and do and go and make. That's why at night, I think. But there's also, of course, the allure of the night and the mysteriousness of that. And then, you know, fog, you know, and then, you know, like the filter that the fog is something that I've really I've really worked with and I've enjoyed. And then at the same time, you know, like just to check myself, I remember like being obsessed about like, oh my God, I can't make all my pictures in the fog. You know, I have to be able to do something else. You know, I can't rely on that as a crutch, you know, that beauty that the fog would bring to my images. So like I deliberately would go out when it wasn't foggy also. And then that led to me not like, you know, after my first couple of books of night photographs came out, I was at that moment, like, I was like, I do not want to be pigeonholed into being just a night photographer. I need to make sure that like I'm able to do other things and I don't just do this. And that's when I started doing my landscape photographs. If people listening to this are young, might, when I say the word filter, they're thinking of a digital filter. but like, I don't ever use any filters in my work, like on my cameras or in my imagery. However, the things that like the fog is a filter, the night is a filter, the shooting through the window is clearly a filter of some kind that modifies the image that you see in that camera. And so those are the kind of things that like, those are the real world filters that like in camera that I've utilized in my work. And that's one of the allures of night and the fog.
Interesting, because that's something I did want to ask you about as well. So I didn't necessarily think about the description of fog as a sort of a natural filter, but the idea of the night as it's like a psychological filter.
It is.
That brings not only something to the photograph when you're making it, but then the viewer, you know, then can project all sorts of, I mean, when I look at those photos, and I grew up in the suburbs of New Jersey and would, you know, wander the streets at night with my friends looking for trouble or whatever.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Like the streetlights, this hitting the sides of the houses, walking by windows in the blue light from TVs, just yes. kind of like filling. Yes. And to me, I look at your photographs and I can, again, that's my projection, but I'm bringing my history, my story to those photographs, and it's at night. So it's not like, you know, I'm on my way home from school and the houses are different colors. It's nighttime. There's this shroud of protection, but also mystery and the nefarious things that could be going on.
Right.
There's a photograph of yours that there's like the circular skid marks that are in, right?
Yep,
and I see that, and I'm so like there's something about it, it's at night, the people are like safe in their house, there's light,
TV lights on,
right?
That particular one has two people watching TV in a different room, and that picture is one of the most that picture is such an important image of mine. 2133 is what it's called, and it's in Maiden Pacifica. And I remember being attracted to, there were two people, and this is actually like a comment on what's occurred in our world recently. I know over the last 20 years, but like there were two people with the lights out watching actual televisions alone at night. And I remember looking at that and I'm like, why aren't they watching TV together? And that was like the main thing I was thinking about. And then later on, I saw those sideshow marks, the skid marks on the road. And then like that picture to me is so important because it's like, you know, like now, like look what happened. Like now, like everybody has a fucking screen in their hand watching something alone in different rooms of their house. There's sometimes five people in a house or however many on their little screen alone watching
or sitting
something.
At the same table staring at
you're right, they can do it at the same table or the same restaurant, and it's just like, gee, what's become of
but those tire marks then like add to me, like then I'm trying to interpret, well, that somebody doing donuts in their car, in the intersection, probably at night, the people are probably in the house, you know, like protected in their little TV lit cocoon. But that says to me that there's, again, like I said earlier, there's like this shroud of darkness that all of these sorts of, like, you know, that may just be like some teenager doing donuts in his car.
Right.
And it's probably, you know, it's somewhat dangerous, but not necessarily like life threatening.
Right.
But
right.
That just those markings add something else to that picture.
I agree.
And so, and then I think about, you know, what I see in a lot of your photographs, you're not necessarily telling me your story, but like I'm seeing stories in those photos, just like you said before, like here you are, you're out at night, you're responding to the light or the framing or the color of the house or whatever it is. That's that charge that you talked about earlier. And then when I come to it, I'm like you said, like, what did they, you know, did they fight? I'm going upstairs. I'm watching the game. You stay down here. Yeah, I'm watching, right. My, you know, meanwhile, there's the juvenile delinquent doing donuts out in the street, which may have been, you know, years ago, could have been like an hour before you showed up.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And so there's all of that. And I look at a lot of your photographs in that same way that it almost, there's, and I'm sure I'm not the first person to say this, and I won't be the last. There's this cinematic quality to it, but it's a still photograph. And I'm just curious to hear your thought, because you don't do video. You don't make
films. I've done some video things, but it's not the primary thrust of what I work on. But you're right. I mean, there's something, there's a quote, there's a Lewis Ball's quote. Photography is a profound corner that sits in between literature and film. And like when I read that, like, you know, when I was in school, and that's in my thesis, like as one of the quotes in there. And like, and that's something that I think about often, that I really love the fact that, like, you know, there's like, you can make movies, you can make moving images, and you can write novels, and you can write poems, but there's something about photography that, like, it hovers in between those spaces that is like, there's something about photography that just has this draw. And I think it's partially because of its silence and its inability to tell you more. And it forces your photography forces you to complete that circle or to bring something to that image. And I think that's why, I mean, of course you're interpreting like literature and film, but there's something about photography because it's quiet and it's still that you have to do as a viewer a little bit more of the work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where that becomes really interesting.
Well, and then to think about, you know, that isn't exclusive to your night house photos.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly, I see it in the, you know, through the windshield photos of the landscapes. I see it in the interiors, some of those interior, I mean, it's like, again, there's the photograph of sort of the bunched up pillow with the headboard behind it.
Yes,
and that light.
Was my bed as a boy. That was like that's where I grew up. I came back home one Christmas from California, and I woke. I got there at night. I went to bed in my old bedroom. I woke up and I looked at that pillow, and I was like, "Well, first of all, I was amazed at like the light on it, but I was also like." Wow, like, why is there no pillowcase on my pillow? You know, and there's just something, there's a story within that bed that's like, it's, you know, for me, I've got that's where I grew up, like, that's my bed as a boy. And I saw something in it, you know, and I'm glad that other people see something in it as well and see something different in it.
Well, So that I didn't know that part of the story behind that photograph, but in some ways, there's a presence, there's a human presence,
yeah,
in that photo, even though there isn't a person in the photo, very much like, you know, the houses, the photographs of houses, there's, you know, they're domiciles that humans live in. It's a human environment, not necessarily seeing a person in it.
Right, right.
So yeah. there's a human presence in your photos, but there's the human absence,
right,
in the photos at the same time.
Right, right. And I agree with that. And that's something that, like, how did I don't know how, honestly, I came to working, to being able to make a photograph like that. But I know that when I see it, and it's something that's like something just happened or is about to happen. And honestly, like, I mean, I don't know where that comes from, honestly, Nick. Like, I just, there's a certain something that, like, that moment of like being able to make a picture that, like, in the middle of something, you know, something's about to happen or something just happened, mm-hmm. you know, and like, and that picture of the bed, I literally had just woken up and the pillow was crushed from my sleeping on it. And I saw the light and I took the picture. And then also with the houses, like, you know, if you look at those houses at night, 99% of them, there's one or two lights on in a window. And so, you know, there's somebody there. You can't ever see anybody. You can't see any person through any window that I photograph mm-hmm. in a house. It's always anonymous. And like, and I wouldn't want to see, there's like, you know, pleasure in not knowing who it is. It's just like, but there's, you know, there's somebody there, you know, that's one of the things, about my work that is, I think, consistent, whether I'm photographing through a window of a car or a room or even a portrait sometimes. It feels like there's a moment that's like about to occur, you know, or yeah. We could go back to that. You're charging the air so that meaning can occur.
That light hitting your pillow that day, was it Christmas, around Christmas time?
It was literally probably Christmas Day.
So like every Christmas of your childhood, that similar light. That
same light happens. Right.
And then you go away. And you come back, and there's like Todd Heido light. Like, it's like, to me, that's the fucking origin story.
Well, I mean, it's kind of what, and then, I mean, you know, and Ohio was always like dark and like gray and all that. So it's funny. My mother always used to like, she loves sun. And of course, because like most people do. And I love clouds. I love like going out in the snow and the rain. And then, my son has, I've transferred that to my son. He loves rainy days too and cloudy days. But that, like the idea that, I like that idea that you just said about like every Christmas, that light is the same on that pillow, probably in that room, even though we don't own that house anymore, but like, whoever is living there, like the light still comes through that window on that day in the same way, depending on whether the weather is, of course. But like, mm-hmm. it's like an interesting thing. It's like the marking of time.
Okay, so here you go. Another little pause in the discussion. If you want to break this one down into digestible chunks, as I've said, maybe this is a good time to pause things. But if you're as enthralled with the conversation as I was when I was recording it, I'm sure you probably just want to keep going with it. And to that end, I'll bring back the last piece of my conversation with Todd Heido. You shared some photos, recent work, this upcoming new book that'll be out next year.
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit about that. And I want to preface it by saying that your brief description in the email that accompanied the photographs, you like You talked about the state of the world. You talked about societal or environmental concerns, obviously, that we're just all humans should be
right
thinking about. But you touched on some of those things in your description. You also used the word, which I made a note of, which is hope. So let's talk about some of the new work and talk about the thinking that was going on while you were making the work and then how that connects to hope. And I'm bringing that up because the descriptions of your work that we've been using in this conversation and now this word hope.
Yes.
Emerging in the conversation.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that and how and talk about the new work.
I think that's excellent. I think that's a great segue into what I'm doing now. And then, so we had, you and I had previously like, you know, and I could actually see that you, when I was talking about my work as a, like longing and loss, I could see, I touched you. Mm-hmm. And I like that. So how do we go from longing and loss to hope? And first of all, I mean, as you can see, and you, as you can hear in me, like, I am not like some dark brooding character that like, is like, you know, angry and like all that, you know, I'm like, you know, I'm, you know, to get to where I've like to get on with my life the way I have, I've had to, hope is an important factor in all of it. And I've learned that from my mother, certainly. But to scroll back for a second, like, we were talking about like a lot of my work came from my childhood, and it came from, like that art therapy, like that interaction with an art therapist, and that I was working on, and I would travel to find a place that looked like home, you know, because that's what I was thinking of. And that's what I would, and then also one of the other things I'd learned from that art therapist is like, oh, duh, you don't drive around like for years and years, like at 15 miles an hour at night, looking at houses with lights on, unless you're illuminating or thinking of something, you know? And so like, so that work was about like, that work was about, you know, coming to terms or like, you know, like exploring my own history on the earth, you know, with my family. But there was something that occurred in my work that changed very much, is that I Aperture had asked me to do, like a mid-career survey, like a chronology of my work, like over 25 years. And that was after having like, I think 5 books published of my work. And that was something that I took very seriously. And then the editor at Aperture, like Denise Wolf, and I, we carefully put together this this chronology of my work. And I remember when it was done, it's called Intimate Distance, and it's available from Aperture. And but it was something that I remember, like when that was all done, I remember thinking like, oh wow, I sort of closed a chapter in some ways. You know, it wasn't a retrospective because it was a mid-career survey, and it was, but it was something like I'd sort of put a lid on something that what I've been working on for years and years. And one of the things that I, recall, like there was one time I went to France, like it was in 2001 October, which was not a good time to go do like a residency in Marseille for an American person. Mm-hmm. I was just like, you know, the world, we didn't know what was going on in the world. We were literally like bombing Afghanistan. And it was just like, it was not the right moment. And so I ended up making like nothing there at that moment because my head was not in it. And I was like thinking about my family at home and, you know, anthrax and all that nonsense. Like, but then, But I remember thinking when I got home, I was just like hit the ground running. And I was like, my work is in America, and my work is about my, where I came from and recollections of that, you know, if you had to put it in a nutshell. And I did that until this book with Aperture was closed. And then after that, it sort of seemed in a way like redundant to go and do the same thing exactly. And so, and I remember like having like, you know, wanting to try. And so I started traveling like with my wife, Marina, to like just different places. Like we went to like, you know, the North Sea of Japan and Hokkaido. We went to Iceland. We went to, you know, Norway, you know, and we went to these places that were really like, you know, like, as you know, I love weather. Like, you know, like there was significantly like something happening in the air, literally. And at that moment, I kind of realized that like I became freed from my own past, and I could make images that were about something other than my recollections of me growing up or a reference to that in some way. When I realized that, I was like, another moment, like mind blown. Okay, I can do whatever I want. And I didn't even know I was restricted, you know, like I had no idea that I had my own personal restrictions. Like, and so then, so I started doing the like work on the landscape, and there was a book that my wife was reading called by A.S. Byatt, Ragnarok, and it was Nordic mythology. And at the very last page, the woman, A.S. Byatt, describes Fimbulvinter, which is the Nordic fear of the apocalyptic winter that just never, ever, ever stops. And she describes darkness, like in levels of darkness. And then, and she said this, and there was this one little, three little letter thing, a three word thing, bright black world. And I remember, and sometimes for me, and I saw that and I read that one sentence, I was like, oh, that's it. Bright black world. That's the name of my book that I was working on at that moment. And that describes exactly what I was photographing, like these dark places where it was like, you know, snowing, and it was like, you know, there were things that like the weather was extreme, and which of course, you know, is what's happening now. This amazing professor at Stanford, Alexander Nemirov, wrote the introduction for that book, and which I was incredibly like lucky. I feel so blessed that he like even notices my work. But in the first sentence of that book, the first sentence of his essay, it's the end sends advance warning. And then again, another moment, I read that and I'm like, I have to use that for my next book, because that's, and then, so sometimes like as a photographer, you can't just roam entirely freely. You got to have a little parameter around what you're doing sometimes. And I've utilized like words and titles as those things, house hunting, you know, roaming, excerpts from Silver Meadows, which is the street I grew up in. It was in my neighborhood in Ohio, bright black world. And then now what I'm working on is this, the end sends advance warning. And, and so that's, you know, kind of what I'm doing. And that's what my work, like I'm, you know, not trying to illustrate that, but like those words bounce around my mind when I'm out looking at things, taking pictures and editing. And so that's what my current work is.
And is that, so the current work, is it, it's in other countries, it's in those environments?
Yes. That's the key thing about it is that it's not like, it's not bound to like my memory of where I grew up. It's about something else that's happening in the world that's much larger than me and my existence on the earth. And it's about like, the thing, and then it's not just about like climate change and about, but it's also about this political darkness that we are steeped in. You know, like I'm a news junkie, you know, like I'm, and you know, for better or for worse, it informs my work. and what's happening in the world. I remember when I was like, when I went to grad school, I was like, I never had cable TV. I'm like, I need to get cable TV because I need to be able to see like what's happening on a broad spectrum. That's never stopped, you know, like in the distance, there's a television on in my kitchen, you know, a little TV that is running the news.
So when I come by your house at night to take a photograph,
there'll be a little glow from that, you know, exactly. A little blue light.
You know, exactly. But let me go back to some of what you were saying about, so you shoot at night in America. You go to these places that have like minimal sunlight for like an hour of sunlight or
right. To
a day. So there's a creative logic to it that you're drawn to it.
Yeah.
And then this existential connection between the sort of the folklore of the place and the idea of this sort of this winter dark snowstorm that will obliterate
Imbo winter, yes.
The our lives.
Apocalyptic winter, yes.
Right, apocalyptic winter. And then you could make correlations between all sorts of environmental collapse or nuclear winter or all of, you know. So to me, there's like, and you said earlier, like, you know, like your art therapist was like, you know, hit you on the side of the head, like, duh, like, this is what I should be doing. It's almost like this time you made that decision and you made sort of like, it's almost like you then became the person to give yourself permission to go. To me, from a audience member, a viewer, a photography enthusiast, there's a logical sort of connection between all of these things.
Uh-huh.
And so, like, but now, like, so you're describing this. I'm like, yeah, of course Todd was doing, you know, like, of course he goes up to the land of no sun.
And like, exactly. I mean, it's funny how like there's this weird little thing I think about. And then as an artist, there's always this, like, I mean, and if you don't have this, like, you're not being realistic with yourself. There's always this fear that, like, what are you going to do next?
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to figure something out? And every time that I've, like, you know, and I know enough to just make work and you figure it out. That's how I work. I make images and I sort them. And that is what I am thinking. And that's Joan Didion. And there's a quote about, like, you know, how do I know what I'm thinking? I'm right. You know, or it's not quite that, but like, it's the gist of what she had said. But like, that's how artists work. It's like we produce, we look, we sort, and then, oh, gee, that's what I'm thinking about. And then, so it makes logical sense. Like that's where I ended up doing, like, you know, like going to Iceland and going to like above the Arctic Circle in Norway and making pictures and, you know, like, and, you know, like you said, like the one thing about those places that, yes, it is like the light's not up there for long, but the but that perfect time when the light is like the sun sets slower there in the winter,
mm-hmm.
than we know about down here in the United States. And it's like, it's just this like slow crawl of like perfection, you know, that is really exciting. And that, and the sun rises the same way too. Mm. And so it, the window of time you can make it work with daylight is smaller, but like, there's something about it. Like the good parts are better, in some way because of the you know, it just happens to be that way. And then, and of course there's the weather, you know, that, which is like, you know, which I enjoy.
Yeah. So, just to sort of draw this to a little bit of a conclusion. So, touch on that idea of hope, then.
Yep.
Or talk to me about, like, I am a bit of an existentialist myself. I think that's pretty much how I view the world. And but I also I was joking with a friend today. I consider myself a closeted optimist is the term that I use.
I'm absolutely an optimist. There's no question about it. Like, yeah. And that's, and I've had to be one, like I said, to get through my life to where I am, you know, and again, I learned that from my mom. But basically, there's something about, like, in my work, I realized that, like, there's so much, there's just, the world is just riddled with, like, problems, like, just, it's relentless. And, you know, and I think that what I'm working on is making pictures that, like, you know, I'm not necessarily illustrating, like, the part that's bad, but that I'm trying to make images that, like, that show this, like, flicker of hope. And you know, we'll leave it, like, we can leave it like at that with, like, it's the light. I always tend to shoot into light. You know, if you look at my pictures, like, there's a light, there's always some light. It's not, light's not behind me. It's in front of me a lot of the time. And so that's kind of like, you know, I just sort of follow the light, like, you know, is like, where do I take the picture? Like, well, where's the light? I go that direction.
So there's the metaphor for hope. There's the hopeful that you're going towards the light.
Yeah.
I love it.
I am.
Yeah. Well, I couldn't ask for a better way to, I think that's a great thing to end on. For this conversation. So, Todd Heido, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me. I hope you enjoyed it, because it was a blast for me.
I very much enjoyed it. It's a pleasure to have a conversation like this with somebody like yourself that, you know, is like a feeling, thinking, responsive human being, and that's part of that light. So yeah. Thank you, Nick.
All right, Todd, thank you. So there you go, my conversation with the great Todd Heido. Just want to give a little shout out to Todd again, thanking him for taking quite a bit of time out of his schedule to chat with me. But I think you could tell that we definitely hit it off, and probably could have kept talking for another hour or so. But in any event, I hope you find this conversation not only entertaining, but also insightful and inspirational for your own work, whatever that work is. I certainly have. And like I said at the onset, this conversation was sort of a validation for my own efforts, certainly with this podcast, but also just having the belief in your own vision and working hard for your own expression, I think is important regardless of whatever medium you happen to work in. So I'll use that as a takeaway from this conversation for sure. If you have any questions or comments, you can go to righteyedominantpodcast.com and scroll to the bottom of the page, and you will find a section there where you can send me comments. I always appreciate hearing from listeners. And if you're new to the podcast, you'll also find all previous episodes at the website as well. Of course, you can always find me on Apple Podcasts and other platforms out there. I think I'm on all of them now. And I would love to get a review or a rating from you if you like what you hear. So with that, I'll sign off for this episode. I want to thank you for listening. This has been the Right Eye Dominant Podcast. I've been your host, Nick Toro Jr. And until next time, stay well. This podcast is a production of righteyedominant.art. The music for this episode has been provided by The Conic Project, Yazar, and The White Plains.